Welcome back, everybody, to the Quill and Query podcast. My name is Brandon Hall, and as always, I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing good, and it looks like we have another special guest. We've been on a streak of interviews here recently, so I'll go ahead and let our special guest, Dirk, introduce himself.
So, first of all, thanks for having me. My name is Dirk Biesinger. I am writing utopian fantasy sci-fi. So, and it's high fantasy and high science fiction. So, it's a little bit a niche combination.
Yeah, and you said utopian, right? Because usually what we hear is like dystopian.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not frequently. Yeah. Very cool. We'll have to dive into that a little bit. We have a lot of fun questions to get into today. But before we get into all that, we like to start with, you know, a little bit of an icebreaker to see how you're doing, what you're currently reading, and just what are you currently up to outside of writing your utopian fantasy?
So what I'm currently reading is an ARC. I'm not going to be naming the book or the author because it's not one that I would be. No, it's not top secret. It's just that I would not rate it very highly. It's a very good idea, a very good basis, but the execution is lagging tremendously. So I would actually suggest to the, or I'm going to be suggesting to this author to going back and actually get a developmental editor to actually develop the story. Mm-hmm. So, but the premise and the foundations are good. So that's why I'm not going to be naming it. Other than that, what I'm up to, we bought 2 years ago an acreage, so it's a lot of renovation around the house that are happening. I just put in, or we just moved the front door. I put in a new front door, and the next big project is there was a attached double garage converted to living room, but that was done improperly, and I'm going to be renovating that, and it's going to be our kitchen and dining space in hopefully about a year. So that's going to be a lot of work there. And on the writing side, I am working on it's probably going to be a thriller, so it has nothing to do with the other books that I have written so far. It's completely independent of that. It's going to be a thriller around AI. So I'm working to pay the bills. I'm working as a machine learning engineer and data scientist. So I am in that field for a lot of years now. I actually need to think back. So I started getting into the field 2012. I made it my income in 2016. So I've got a few years in there, and the current developments ethically, I would say, are questionable. And that is what this thriller is going to be actually exploring a little bit more in depth, why it's questionable and what is the background behind it, and also a little bit of the technical foundation. It's definitely tiered towards the interested folks, so it's not the technical folks. The technical expertise is not required to read it. So it's for everyday interested folks about AI and what the current state and the problematics are in a thriller form.
Amazing. Busy.
Yeah. I always admire people who can take on the renovation projects themselves, because I'm very much in the mindset of like, I would just hire someone else to do it so I don't have to deal with the headache. But I wish I could do it. I really do. I'm just not built for it. What about you, Ash? Have you been up to any good reads lately?
Nothing super great. I've kind of paused as I'm trying to work a bit more on the novel, so I have been reading less. Some fun news, I did get published in a poetry anthology, which was exciting. That came out last week, I think. So that was super fun. But other than that, yeah, just truly working, if not at my job, on this book. So yeah, what about you, Brandon? Anything cool?
Yeah. I'm kind of taking a break from reading at the moment. I'm trying to do get back into the habit of daily writing, since this is, you know, technically NaNoWriMo, but not really anymore. Trying to write like I'm trying to hit between 500 and 1,000 words a day. We'll see if I can maintain that for the rest of the month. But I've started a separate project I've been doing a separate project for November, separate from A Knight of Knives, to kind of get some momentum, and, you know, because I'm still kind of stuck on Act 2 of A Knight of Knives, so, it's been really fun. It's like I don't want to spoil too much, because I don't know if it'll ever actually be finished, but it's like a sort of space opera story, so that's been really fun to write, but, I haven't been reading much, just because that's kind of consuming my free time after work, so...
That's
what I've been up to. Excellent. All right. Well,
at least we're all staying busy and not just, languishing and not doing anything.
I wish. Dirk, I guess we can go ahead and dive into the interview questions. As we can see, you came very prepared, so no need to waste time here. You told us a little bit about the books you like to write and your background as a writer, but I want to dive more, I guess, specifically into that niche you said about utopian fantasy and sci-fi. Tell us a little bit about what that means for someone who's not used to hearing that term.
How would I best explain that? The typical fantasy book that you would be picking up, it doesn't matter which one it is, is a relatively, there's always a lot of aggression in there and always a aggressive conflict in there that needs to be resolved to actually get to the point to have a better world or a better situation. That is the general plot. Or the general arc, I would say, in broad terms. And this necessitates that the books are relatively dark. So there is always the problems, there is always the danger, there is always the risk, and there is always fighting and injury and all kinds of, I would say, what you could experience as negative things. And I wanted to go and explore what would it actually be after you are in that better place, after all this dystopian period. So the world that I created definitely has a dystopian period, but the books that I'm writing are actually after the dystopian period. How does the society actually look after they are through that? How would a society live there? It doesn't mean that there is no conflict, it doesn't mean that everything is good. We're talking about human nature, so it can't be like that. It would not be realistic or plausible. Looking at it on a population on a global scale, how could society actually look after they have learned and are living more in a more conscience and more in a positive way for the good of the society, not the me, I need to battle everybody that even looks my way kind of thing. How could it actually look if working together is kind of the mantra? And that is what I'm exploring in these books.
Sounds like a very unique...
How does... Sorry, is there a delay with me today?
I think we have a slight delay.
It's okay if there is. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Ash.
No, I was just going to ask, how, I guess this is a different question, but it ties into this, how much fantasy is in this kind of more sci-fi realm in terms of your work?
Again, I'm going in there and actually explore it in a different way. So, for example, if you take Aragorn, and the book Aragorn, and this follows Aragorn, who actually discovers the egg, and then the dragon is hatching, and he needs to learn. But he has the big advantage that there are resources available to learn. He finds somebody actually in his village, basically waiting for a dragon rider to emerge, and who teaches him that. And I wanted to explore, so if there would be magic discovered, if there would be dragons discovered, and nobody is around to actually teach, how do you go about it? How do you rediscover that if there is nobody around who actually knows anything about it? And that is additionally what I'm actually exploring in this world. So yes, it's a complete sci-fi world, very far in the future, but with magic and dragons.
Love it.
So.
So would you say there, I know you said you write in a bit of a niche genre, would you say there's any other authors in this space that have had a direct impact on you that write in this same genre, or are we looking at inspiration more in other places?
I have yet to find an author that actually writes this deeply in this niche. So there is... what's her name? Le Guin with the Dispossessed. That's a 1950s, 1960s book, but that's sci-fi. It's mostly utopian sci-fi. There is also a bit of dystopian in there, but it's mostly utopian sci-fi. But it's not fantasy. So this combination with fantasy and sci-fi and utopian, I have not found anybody yet who actually has written something in there. And so the inspiration is coming actually from multiple directions. I read very early, I think I was about 10, 11 years old when I read Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. So that was relatively early. And I was always fascinated with fantasy and always fascinated with sci-fi. So there is quite a number of influences of pretty traditional sci-fi authors and fantasy authors. So Tolkien and I already mentioned Aragorn there, of course, Martin. And on the sci-fi side, definitely Asimov, or it's actually a German book. I have it back here, this one here. Which is a quite an influence. Actually also the Foundation TV series that they are putting together, I find that pretty interesting. And The Expanse. So what I like about The Expanse and what I actually took out of The Expanse is the realism. So how likely it actually is that everything would be possible as it is described in The Expanse, from the technical point of view, from the timelines, from the economical, from the social points of views, down even to the language combination that they are speaking. So The Expanse there is highly realistic, or probably realistic. And I wanted to take a page out of that, and that is what I'm kind of gauging myself against, is the level of The Expanse there? Is everything what I'm writing, everything that I'm putting together from a technical point of view, the planetary mechanics, all of that, is that on that kind of level? So I know that my planetary mechanics are completely in order because I've got complete simulations set up to actually make sure it is realistic, including the calendar, moon phases, or moon's phases. The world has two moons. How the complete system is actually set up, how the galaxy is set up there, how the solar system there is set up. Everything is perfectly in order there because I'm calculating everything to the day, to the hour, actually. So I know it exactly.
That's awesome.
It fits exactly. And this is a combination of all those influences and kind of morphing a bit between the questions here. Why I actually started writing, or when I actually started writing, it was only about just a bit more than 2 years ago. It was November 4th, 2023. I lost my job end of October 2023 and was sitting on a trove of information for a video game. We've been collecting and creating maps and creating ideas, cataloging ideas for a large video game in the family for near to 20 years, but don't have the funds or the means to actually make a video game. So I have been for quite a while, at that time I had already for quite a while contemplated what can I do with this trove of information that we have. It's several thousand pieces, bits and pieces of information all over the place. So what can I do with that? And the idea always was to go really multimedia, not just a video game, but also use other avenues. And then having the time on my hand and actually having decided that, yes, if I can't use it for video games, going the avenue with books would actually be making sense. So one and one came together and I started writing. So that's where how it all started. And this video game is, the concept of the video game was kind of an educational point of view. So as an example, if you look at the statistics that you get starting in the US here, if you actually look at the statistics and 80% of folks in a job are not happy with the job that they're having. So you could also look at it in a different way. 80% of folks are wasting their time doing something that they don't want to do. And that is a tremendous waste on a national level. Now, the U.S. is only 5% of the population, approximately, of the world. Now, if you actually go further out and assume that it is somewhat similar to the rest of the world, we are talking about the potential of billions of people that is not utilized. On a global scale, on the population, on the human population scale, on our planet, we are wasting millions of work years every day with stuff that nobody wants to do. What kind of a waste is that? What kind of, how stupid is that, quite frankly?
Yeah.
So the idea of this video game was to actually kind of hold that mirror in front of folks. Do what you want to do, not in not doing what you need to do, but if you have to spend time needing to do something, make sure it's something that you also want to do, that gives you something, that there is a benefit for yourself, not just a waste of your time. A few more things like what it actually means as a society, what it means in interaction with nature, with how you actually also use resources or recycle resources, reuse resources. All this was part of the concept of the video game. And I'm keeping that for the book. So how actually would life look if you could design it yourself? Not within the confines of the society, but how could a society a society look and life in a society look if you could design it yourself. And that is kind of the mirror that I want to offer here with these books and get people to just reflect a little bit. And then going forward, when they're making decisions that impact their lives or the course of their lives, perhaps they're a little bit more conscious about it and make perhaps a different decision. And it starts small that you actually create change. And that's what this is about.
Love it. I'll let you tackle the next question, Ash.
Okay, will do. I always feel like good sci-fi does that. It just like holds up a mirror to our current system. So that's super exciting. Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of the craft for you. Can you walk us through what a typical writing day looks like? And if you would consider yourself more of a plotter or a pantser? So just walk us through your process.
So I'm somewhere between a plotter and a pantser. So my storylines are pretty complex. Typically in a book, I have 3 to 4 actually parallel storylines that are then also interweaving. Because of the complexity that I have in the book with the storylines, I'm also using multiple POVs. And I am limiting the timeline as always going forward. So there is no time jumps or anything like that in the book itself or in the chapters itself, unless it is in a dialogue and basically folks are talking about something that happened in the past in history or something like that. But then it's explicit in there. It's not just that the timeline of the book itself is jumping around. It's always moving forward. And so I'm laying out corner points, and that's very meticulously planned, actually, for the plots, as well as actually character development or story arc development. That is very meticulously laid out. Also, I'm laying out details that I need to introduce for future storylines. So it's multiple books. The saga is multiple books, and there is actually already a few Easter eggs in the first book for stuff that is going to be coming in the fourth and the fifth and the sixth book. But these details are already introduced there, and that is all very meticulously planned. And so there is quite a bit of time going into that planning. It's not planned to all details because I really like the ride when my characters are jumping then on the page and all hell breaks loose and they're just taking me along on the ride. So I really like that. And that is completely pantsing them and then really let them rip loose on the page. For example, what this leads to. So my prequel that I wrote, so Xavier of Chemain, I wanted to write a magnet for a free giveaway for a newsletter. And that is what I ended up with. So it started as a small magnet. Then it became a novella. And it's now a 93,000 word book. So it's actually a full novel. And that is what is happening with these kinds of things. Or what I'm releasing right now. So I have released the book 2 of the saga September 19th, and book 3 is coming out November 19th. Actually was originally book 2. The problem is it's 800 pages to combine. So it was a little bit too much for one book. It's about 230,000, 235,000 between the two books. So I actually split it into two because it was just too much. That is what is happening when with the pantsing. So there's always so much more that actually can go into the stories. And I have to limit myself. Always. I have to limit myself so much with the world building. So I'm still introducing the world. So I'm literally 500,000 words into the complete story saga. And the world is perhaps introduced to a third from the societal part and from the area, from the regions. I would say I'm not even at 10% of the world. So it's just started from that point of
That's
view.
So exciting though.
Yeah.
There's so many futures. Yeah.
Yes. There's so much more to explore. So yes, it's a combination between the two. And then I'm doing review processes. I have a relatively elaborate review process because I need to make sure that all the details are actually accurate. That is what is why I'm going. Typically, I'm going through the books 5 to 6 times in review stages to really go over all the details. Sometimes while I'm writing, I tend to info dump. So there is perhaps 3-4 pages, plain info dump in there. I resolve those info dumps in that I'm actually distributing them a little bit around in the area. So some info dumps are getting distributed over 150, 200 pages in segments. How it's actually then fitting into dialogue or into the development of the story. To resolve those info dumps, that is part of the review process. So this means if my first draft is certain amount of words, I know that the finished story is probably about 15 to 20% more, simply because of all the review that is happening with the grounding, with putting a bit more detail into the scenes, with fleshing out the scenes a little bit, and mainly with resolving those info dumps. And somewhere in between there, my wife is my closest ally in this adventure. So she's getting she's doing the alpha reading. And then there is some refinements coming from there. I have a couple beta readers where the book is going to then, and that is then also additional refinements. So I would say, and that probably kind of goes already to the question, what I would suggest for upcoming writers or interested writers. You need to figure out the process that works for you. A process that works for me, it doesn't work for Ash, it doesn't work for Brandon. Everybody has their own process, and you need to learn about yourself what works for you, what works for your writing styles, for the type of stories that you're telling, how your brain is ticking, that it is the most enjoyable process that you have to actually getting your stories from up here onto the page.
Great advice.
Love that advice. Yeah. Well, thank you for tackling that one from the doc. Like we said, we knew you were well prepared. So I'm going to shift over to another question since you already answered that one. We talked a little bit about your process. So do you have a favorite part of the writing process or a least favorite part, and what would those be?
So I really like doing the first draft because that is simply where the time flies for me. That is where I can really immerse. It's like reading a book for me if I'm at the first draft. It's really discovering it all. I know what the corner points are beforehand, but all the details, all the what actually then happens is like reading a book. It's discovering it. In those stages, when I get really into the groove, Brandon, you mentioned it earlier that you're trying to get between 500 and 1,000 words per day on the page. I wrote my The draft for my first book, that was, the first draft was, I think, about 123, 127,000 words. I wrote that in 7 weeks.
Wow.
So,
that's
got to
be a record.
no, actually not. If I'm getting really into the groove, I'm writing only in the evening. So it's not a full-time job for me. So I have a few hours every evening that are reserved for writing. And when I get really into the groove, then I am at, I'm averaging 3,500, 4,000 words a day. Mm. So when I'm in the first draft. The number of revisions that I'm doing, that is one of the mediocre parts, I would say, and the least favorite part of the whole book publishing, being an indie author part, is actually the marketing. I'm not a very, not that socially outgoing. I'm not a very extrovert person. So it's, that is giving me the hardest times, and it's the least enjoyable, actually, as aspect of the whole journey for me.
Yeah,
I've had people say the same about the marketing thing. Yeah. A lot of people just, you know, it's a necessary evil almost, but that tends to be people's least favorite as well. So
yeah, it seems to be a common point of contention.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Did you want to take the next one, Ash?
Sure. I'm also just pausing in case there is a delay. I don't want to interrupt anybody. Totally. Okay. So yeah, you mentioned that you're a pretty tech savvy guy. Are there any tools that you use specifically for writing? You mentioned something about, you know, your planet and the moons and the phases and things like that. So talk to us about what you're using to kind of get that granular with your world building.
I'm actually right now looking into how I want to construct the maps of the world. So I have a hand-drawn map. It's actually just hanging up here over top of my desk. It's a 4 by 6 foot map of the world. And it's completely hand-drawn. And everything is penciled in there. And it's completely covered. I'm looking into... I took actually the outlines of the world, of the two continents, and created that as geospatial data. So what basically geologists on Earth are using to map our land masses or everything for making maps, that what they're using. So I have those external points or the contours of the continents already done. I'm looking actually into using tectonic software to create the complete realistic maps for the world. Not just painted maps, but actual maps that you could explore, very similar to Google Earth. If you're going into Google Earth to explore Earth in 3D, something like that, that is where I want to take that. And for that, I'm looking into using it's a tectonic calculating software that you actually can use to then create your tectonic plates and then let them simulate how it actually works, how everything is going up. So that is what I'm working on for actually creating the maps for the world. Other tools are probably scary simple, what I'm using. My writing software is Microsoft Word. I'm just using a proper template. So I have been using Word since the version 5.0. That's 1989. So that's how long I have been using Word. So I know the limitations of Word and how you need to use it correctly to actually realize the potential that is in the software. And that is what I'm making sure. The book covers are literally hand painted by the wife. So it's acrylic paintings that we are then taking in. Let me see. So this is actually part of this third book that I overlay over another picture. This is art that is going to be becoming bookmarks in the near future. I'm working on that. And so that is where the background art is coming from. And then I'm taking that and use PowerPoint to actually make my book covers. So the book covers are made in PowerPoint for the text effects, but graphics are actually basically photographed of or scanned in hand aquarelle paintings, and that's the background of it.
Wow, that's so impressive. Like, truly everything is done in-house. So that's very...
Not the editing. I've got a line editor that is not in-house.
Right. That would be wild if you also had a friend who is a line editor, and then truly everything is in-house.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah, very so cool. I don't think I've ever heard of anyone doing their book covers in PowerPoint before. That's a very unique approach to it. So.
Yeah, it is.
PowerPoint is extremely powerful for positioning things accurately. And it's very powerful actually for text effects. Mm. So and it's not that great for art. But I don't need to be concerned by the art because the art is a background picture.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, and because of that, it's the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit to actually use it in this way.
Do you find that when you're kind of building your maps and kind of really working on the tectonic plates and how things are moving, do you find that grounds you more, even more in your world and your writing process than just, let's say, hand drawing your maps or things like that? Does it become more tactile for you as the author?
It's not about it being more tactile. It's about it about being spatially more accurate. So I'm a total stickler for the spatial, temporal, or also motion accuracy. If I'm describing a fighting scene or something like that, or a challenge scene in my books with multiple actors in it, then every single step is completely mapped out. So I have it completely mapped out how everything is moving. All the data is completely mapped out. So in the first book, there's basically news missives are coming with where there needs to be a pattern, alphabetical and numerical pattern in there. And that is all completely in detail mapped out before I'm writing. So I'm a complete stickler for those details, because how my brain works, I pick up on those inaccuracies. So I take, if I'm reading a book, I know what is inaccurate in those books and what is not making sense. And those take away my pleasure of reading the book, because it's... I've got another book up there that also actually has a little bit of an effect on my writing career. When I started writing, or why I actually started writing and self-publishing, it's actually this book, Fourth Wing. So, and
oh wow.
And in that series are so many inaccuracies There's so much illogical in there. I think I counted so far 23 plot points in Fourth Wing alone that are completely illogical, that are not fitting at all, that are not making any sense, that completely would make the storyline impossible if they would be accurate, actually. So this whole storyline only works because of those mistakes. And that is something that is a blunder that I don't afford myself to make. So that's why all the details are plotted out very meticulously.
That's so funny. Before we move on, I could not stand Fourth Wing. Sorry for anyone who's listening who didn't like it. But I didn't like it for those almost like throwaway points of, I wanted to know why these things worked the way they did, and there was never any explanation, and then all these... Anyway, I totally agree with you about Fourth Wing. It gave me some motivation to think that, like, oh, I'm actually doing better because I'm making sure that my world building is, like, so sound and watertight so that none of those things happen. So, anyway, just wanted to say that.
Yeah, I have not read Fourth Wing, but... I think we have a slight delay.
Fourth Wing was, for me... kind of a motivation, because when I actually read that book and figured, okay, if a book of that quality can have this kind of hype, anybody can have some form of success as an indie author. So that completely took away all the barrier, all the angst of actually getting started for me. Because, in my opinion, this book does not deserve that hype. And if a book like that can be hyped to that heights, then everybody can have some form of success.
I fully agree with you. That's my mantra often, is if Fourth Week can get published, I can get published. Or I can publish and it be a success, you know? So, yes. Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's a good lesson to take from Fourth Wing. Dirk, I know you have a few books out. Are there any lessons that you've learned kind of from publishing each one that you've taken into the next book and so on, like that you plan to take into this next one that you're writing as well?
It's a road. It's not a destination. So, of course, with every book that you're publishing, with every page that you're writing, there is so much more that you actually could tell. And it's always something that you're always learning, you're always developing as an author. It's a craft. By writing, you are honing your craft. And by editing, you are reviewing, you're learning out of what you have written. And by reviewing, you are correcting yourself, you are leveling yourself up. And having done that through a complete book, when you start the next book, drafting the first draft on your next book, of course it's going to be influencing it. Because how every book that you have read before is influencing you, every book that you have written is influencing you even more. So it's a much more intense influence. And because of that, the subsequent books are always going to be influenced. I listened to Ben Shankman's interview from last week with you guys. He said that the corporation that he did is not the best work that they did because they were on a timeline. In a time crunch, and that is something that I think is important, a takeaway here. For good writing, you need to be aware of the schedule. You can't be on a time crunch. If you are on a time crunch for good writing, it doesn't work. So make realistic schedules. I know that I can make very aggressive schedules because I know how my process looks like. And because of that, I can schedule it, and I know how aggressive I can schedule it. And this means I started writing the two books that I published September and November this January. So I literally did go between January and beginning of September. I wrote and finished 230,000 words this year in two books. I know that I can do this aggressive schedule if I'm scheduled right, because I know how my process works. And I think that is what is very important here. Don't rush your process. Figure out your process. I completely revised my first book. It was originally published February 1st, 2024. So 3 months after I started writing, I published the first version of the book. But I did go in and did go through the complete beta cycle and redid that and did a complete multiple revisions and editing and professional line editing and re-released it in May of this year. So I even, within the writing, I even did all that for the first book to actually re-release that because I know how my schedule looks and how my my process looks. And that is what is the important part here. You can be fast, but you can't rush.
That's a very subtle distinction, I think, that a lot of people, myself included, have a hard time with. You know, there's like a determination to finish and get it, at least the first draft and second draft, kind of fully formed and done. But you're right, there's also something to be said about like knowing your pace and being consistent, and as long as it can take as long as it needs to. But yeah, the rushing component, I think there's something to be said about having a challenge, like what can you do in a short amount of time, like if there's like a writing challenge or something like that to kind of work on your craft. But yeah, when you care so much about your novel, it's good to take your time.
Ash, I'll let
you
take
that. What is the you just gave us some good advice. What is the worst advice you have ever heard as when you started writing, and even now, have you heard any like really just crappy advice?
The kind of advice that in general really makes me running for the hills is if somebody drops into DMs or into a video, as a writer, you must do. You have no idea how I'm writing, what I'm writing, how my process is, how my schedule looks, how my life looks. You can't tell me how I must do things. Just because it works for you and because you want to sell your method doesn't mean I need to listen to you. So all these must-dos or you have to do things or anybody who wants to offer you something and then turn around and sell you something, that is, in general, I'm very, very cautious about those, to be polite here, because first of all, they are interested in selling their stuff. They're not interested in helping you. They are interested in making you feel like you are getting help. But first of all, they're interested in selling their product. So that's why I don't participate in awards where there is an entry fee. If it's for commerce, then it's not an award that I want to have. Because they are interested, they have a financial incentive in it. So how much of a independent award or a proper, honest award can it be if there is a financial component to it? So if there is an award and they are asking for an entrance fee, nope. Thank you very much.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So I'm not participating in that. Also, a lot for ethical reasons, you don't find me on Meta platforms. And because of the ethical reasons, what they are trying to push and how many bots are actually on those platforms now. 80% of the interaction there is with bots. Okay, there's no realistic interaction there, at least for me. It's not time well spent. That's why I'm not on Meta platforms or Xitter. Twitter. It's not. Twitter, yes. I'm not on that platform either. Point in case there. If a platform requires you to sign up before you actually get to see what they have to offer, then this tells me they're desperate. Okay, I don't need to enable somebody who is desperate. If you can't convince me with your product, with your service, without forcing me to jump through hurdles and actually give up my private data and my private contact information and sign up for something, or even give you my credit card information, before I can see what you have to offer, I'm not interested. So all those extreme pushy things is, in general, I would say, is where I steer clear of.
Smart.
I'm not spending that time.
I wasn't aware that there's awards that charge an entry fee. Yeah, that I would feel very off put by that as well. All right. Well, we talked a little bit about your releases. You have a few books out there, so I imagine you've received both from beta readers and people who have read the finished product feedback. So, how do you handle negative feedback, and I guess just feedback in general when it comes to your writing?
I'm not concerned with negative feedback simply because I know that my books are a very specific niche, which means it's not going to be for everybody. So because of that, there is going to be negative feedback. So overly religious folks that have had a look at my books have given me negative responses. It might be simply because I'm expecting everybody to be far too open, far too curious, far too open-minded for very religious people to be appealing to them. So I'm absolutely fine with that. It is for, I would say, for a very specific kind of person that my my books are appealing. And this means it's a subset of the population. It's not for everybody. So this means there is quite a number of folks that wouldn't like my books. So that is what is to be expected. And realistically speaking, it's what everybody, every author has to expect. A horror author would not get good feedback for me. Horror books or even horror movies are not what I'm interested in. That's absolutely not for me. So I still remember when I was experimenting with reading different genres, and I read Stephen King when I was, I don't know what age I was, but I still remember that. And decades later, as no, I don't want to have that kind of emotional response to what I'm reading. It's not what I'm interested in. It's not for me. So everybody their own. And this means that my books are not for everybody, period. It's that simple. But sometimes feedback is a little bit stumbling. So I had feedback, I heard it a few times, that my books are very unconventional and that I'm taking a great risk with my books. And I didn't understand where this is coming from for quite some time, because for me, books are experimentations. So with books, you're creating worlds, you're creating imaginary worlds, you're creating thought experiments. And as such, what can be risky was thinking about something. And it took me a while to actually understand. The really big risk that I'm taking is I don't adhere to the established formula of what a fantasy book is. Not at all. Sure. I'm taking a lot of liberties. I'm violating so many traditional publisher rules that my book has no chance to be picked up by a traditional publisher. Absolutely no chance.
That is a great badge of honor, I feel like, though, to be so unique that you know traditional publishing wouldn't take you, because there's, I mean, that's I don't know, that's very, very cool in my brain to just like have that kind of mentality.
Yeah, so actually, so this is my first book. And this is how far you actually have to go in this book, right here on page 75. That is the first page that actual gender of any of the characters is mentioned.
Oh, wow.
So you have to go through all this without knowing what gender the characters are.
Yeah. And was that purposeful?
Yes, absolutely on purpose, because I want to deliver the message that gender, hair color, skin color, eye color, height, build are attributes of a person. It's not the definition of a person, and that is what I'm doing there. So they are interacting with each other in this environment without knowing the other's race, for example. And it's only at this point that there is a distinction between the genders that is coming in there, or that this is becoming a thing, that there is a difference. And the whole book, the whole premise of all the book is everybody is doing what they can do best and what they want to do, how they want to contribute to the society. There is no limitation because of the gender or the height or the skin color. Everybody is doing what, how they want to contribute. And that is what I'm using there to actually drive that home. So folks that know each other from before that transition, they are not aware of the others being of a different race. They are discovering it after they grew up, literally grew up with each other. They're 20 years old and they're discovering, oh, you're a different race. But it doesn't change. It doesn't change the person. And that is what I'm, that is what I'm using here to drive that home. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It should not matter.
Yeah. No, especially nowadays, that's a good message to kind of drive home, especially if you're working within like the utopian sci-fi lens, you know, where dystopian usually really draws on those differences and those divides. Utopian, what does the after look like? You know, what is society? Who doesn't care about that kind of stuff? What they can do. So very cool. Very interesting. All right. I think our next question, as we're kind of slowly coming towards the end, you're talking about, you know, your book, the books that you've had. You're publishing again this month, right? Tell us more about the books in progress and what the future holds with your writing.
So, yes, I have published already. So it's book one is out. Book two is out. That came out in September 19th. Then the prequel is out, and book three, I don't have a proof copy. It's in the mail right now. It's coming out November 19th. Or the latest version of the proof copy is coming out, is in the mail. So those are what is coming out this year. I'm working on a thriller that is not related to the saga that will come out somewhere beginning of the first half next year. That is what I'm planning on. And I'm really looking forward to the next year in the saga. So the original plan was one book per year. So it's kind of a college setting here, a five-year college. And the original idea was one book per year, but I needed to sunset that concept because the second year is actually two books. I'm already kind of plotting and story arcs, the details for the third year. So that is already, the plotting is already in progress for that book. I'm calling it right now just book four of the saga, but I'm kind of fearing that I need to do again more than one book. It's probably even more than the second year. It actually might even be three books. We will see. I've got too many ideas, too much to pack into there. So that is what is coming, and I'm aiming for the actual book four coming out September 19th next year. So September 19th is in the books actually transition day, and that's why it's important for the transition day that the books are actually coming out that are dealing with the transition day or starting on transition day. So the books are going from transition day to the next transition day. So that's why I'm using that kind of symbolism to release the next year, or the start of the next year of the books, on September 19th on the same day.
Oh, awesome. Can I ask really quickly why you have chosen to kind of shift a little bit to thriller, like a standalone thriller, or shifting genres? Is this something you've always been interested in, or were you inspired by something?
Because it's kind of the same kind of idea. I think I have a pretty deep understanding of what actually is happening in the AI scenes, how those whole algorithms are working, what is the motivation of the companies behind it, or the players behind it, not just the companies, the players behind it. And with working in data science and having worked for quite a number of renowned companies, I know or have a good insight of actually the questionable paths in the ethics, what is behind it. So I think with where we are right now in this whole AI adventure, being careful here, there is a lot of not available information. So I pushed for or asked for ethics education around AI 3-4 years ago, is when I started actually pushing for that, or asking for that, or evaluating if there is an appetite for it. And as scary as that might be, in none of the big companies, there is any appetite for it. So,
I wonder why.
This exactly that wonder why, that is the question, and everybody should be concerned with that question. And that is where this idea for this thriller is coming in. This is shining a light behind the scenes of this AI hype, lifting the curtain, looking behind it, explaining what it actually is and what it isn't. What are the capabilities, what are the use cases, and what are proper use cases, what are improper use cases for where we are, and what actually would need to happen to be where everybody is marketed to that we are. So how far is actually the delta between what the marketing is promising or implying and where we technically are. So kind of showing that gap, educating about that, educating about the ethics portion of it. This is where this thriller is coming in, because this is missing. Everybody is just trying to sell their technology or trying to sell educational materials, how to use the technology. Everybody is fear-mongering. If you're not using it, you're going to be falling professionally behind and you're going to be left by the wayside in months from now. Everybody is beating that drum, and nobody is saying, okay, let's step back. What is actually a proper use case? What is an ethical use case? What are all these companies up to? How are they ticking? And why are they doing what they're doing? Why is it possible that companies have billions of dollars to burn on compute time without producing anything?
Right.
What is the motivation behind there? Not the financial motivation, but the psychological motivation, the ethical motivation, and where is this going? And this then also answers, should we be wary about that? Or in what cases should we be wary about that? So that is kind of the gaps that I want to fill and educate about. And that's where the thriller is coming in. That's the purpose of that.
Very poignant time to be putting this out, so I'm excited for it. Brandon, I'll let you ask the next question.
Yeah, I'll tackle this last one. So, Dirk, this one's going to be a little bit different than what we've asked you for the majority of the interview, but I like to end with this one. If you could reread any one book for the first time, forgetting everything you knew about it and experiencing it, you know, fresh all over again, what book would you choose and why?
I actually have been thinking quite a while about this question. I know you you have it in your questionnaire, and it took me a while to actually come up with an answer. And and why? And the book is actually The Lord of the Rings. And the reason being, for one, I read it when I was relatively young. It greatly influenced me as it is. But I read it when I was relatively young. So all the intricacies with the society and the world building that Tolkien is doing were, I don't want to say were lost on me, but were not that deeply impressive on me. And the second reason why this book is, because I read it in German. I read a translation, and at that point, at that time, the translations were done, that book was translated somewhere late 1960s, early 1970s. And how the translations then were done, even names were translated. So a lot of the detail meaning of the names, of the naming of things, what the meaning actually is lost, literally lost in translation. So because of that, I would love to read this book new, but in original English. So And because of that, I think it would be a complete different experience. And that is why I have to go with that one.
That's a good choice and a good reasoning, I think. That's a very fair translation can be a problem for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. Everyone always says this one gives them like the most pause when I send them the questions. They have to think about that one the most.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. It's a good question. It's a good question.
Yeah.
Especially
I like
if you're an avid reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to choose from. All right. Well, Dirk, I think our last audience member is gone for right now, but is there anything that we didn't touch on that you have to say to the audience as we get ready to wrap up here?
I think that the most important part, it doesn't matter reader or writer, is be conscious about where you spend your time. And as a writer, don't fret about all the details. Brandon Sanderson is overdoing it to one extreme by saying to not get into world building paralysis, but kind of just wing it. I don't completely subscribe to that mantra because world building is important and world building needs to be thought through beforehand. But it's not necessary to go into all the nitty-gritty and details. It's not necessary to have, if you have religions in your world, of actually having the religious texts completely written down for each of the religion. Mm. It's not necessary to have recipes down for all regions of your world. It's not necessary. It's necessary to have a general idea of what kind of recipes would be in a certain region. So, for example, if you have a region that is a hotter climate, you could say that the typical recipes there would be Southern Indian. Or in this region, it would be British recipes, traditional British recipes. Or in this region, it would be Baltic recipes. Or here, it would be Southern China recipes. Here, it would be Mexican recipes, stuff like that is completely sufficient. And then when you actually describe something in that region and you're describing food stands or something like that, then you can go into more detail and explore that more. To actually have a fitting world, you need to go to some detail, but not all the detail. So finding that balance and being conscious about how much time you spend on building enough detail, but not too much detail. Being conscious about the time that you're spending on it, that is important. And as for the readers, if you don't like a book, it's okay to DNF. Mm-hmm. Don't spend your time with a book that you don't like. I personally would not continue reading a book that I know if I'm 20% in or something like that, and I know it's not going to be better than a 2-star review. Do I really want to spend the rest of the time reading it, or would I rather prefer reading something that I, or even reread something that I rated as a 4 or 5-star? Would I rather spend the time with that? Be conscious about what you spend your time on. Time is the one currency that you can't recoup. Mm-hmm. If it's gone, it's gone.
Wise words. I totally agree about the DNFing. I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but some people like to finish and just say they finished, but I am... Yeah, in the same vein as I could be utilizing my time differently. I could be reading another, a different arc that is much better and giving that author the time that I think that book deserves versus this. So I'm a huge proponent of that.
All right. Well, Dirk, it's been great having you on Quill Inquiry. Thank you for all the wisdom and advice you were willing to share about your process and just all the wonderful tips you gave to new writers and readers as well with the DNF. A dog is chiming in somewhere, so he distracted me.
They agree.
But congratulations on the upcoming release. We'll be sure to link that in the description for you when we see the Amazon link. And if anyone has any questions in the comments when this goes up on YouTube, I'll forward those to you. But I think that's going to do it for this episode of Quill Inquiry. So once again, just thanks for giving us your time. And we look forward to seeing much more from you in the future.
Yeah. Thanks, Dirk. Appreciate it. We'll have to have you on when your thriller comes out next year so we can talk more about AI and all that mess.
It is a mess. Thanks for having me. And it's I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Good. We'll definitely have you. Thanks again. And hope you have a good night. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone.